Welcome to the fifth episode of the Ask the Expert podcast. I am Christoph Schulze, project manager at The Autonomous. So those of you who are not familiar with The Autonomous, we are an open platform bringing together global players in autonomous mobility to collaboratively work on the biggest challenges in our domain. Today is a special day for The Autonomous and me, thanks to our guest. If I ask you to name one of the experts in the international field of automotive safety, there might be approximately five names that come to your mind. If I tell you that our guest today is coming from the United States, this number might reduce to two or three. If you are familiar with the UL 4600, you know that our guest today is Phil Koopman. Phil has been a professor at the Carnegie Mellon University for more than 26 years. He is specialized in embedded systems, software safety, and autonomous vehicle testing. As mentioned earlier, he is also the lead author behind the UL 4600 standard that has been released recently in a second edition. Phil, it's an honor and great pleasure to talk to you today.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
As a warm-up, let us start with an easy question. When I was living in Stuttgart a couple of years ago, I had a German flatmate with the same surname as yours. He told me that Koopman, or actually Koopman, would be Dutch and translates to merchant. Did you know that?
Yes, I did, because my ancestors are from Holland, Michigan. And that's the only town in the U.S. where they pronounce my last name correctly, I've come to find out.
Okay, interesting. Okay, Phil, then let's start with the more serious questions. As you might know, the overall goal of The Autonomous is to bring companies and research institutes together to work on increasing the safety of autonomous vehicles, especially on SAE Level 4. My question is, why is safety so important in the context of autonomous driving?
Well, I think there are a couple reasons beyond the obvious that you don't want cars crashing. I think everyone can agree you don't want cars crashing. But there are two things that are different compared to conventional vehicles. The first is that there's no human in control. Well, that's sort of the point of level four, right? But that actually has huge implications for how you do safety. Current safety takes credit for the fact that there's a human who can deal with all the weird stuff that wasn't handled in the design or surprises or the unexpected. And now there's no human in control. And that has a problem that there's no human to deal with weird stuff. But the other one is there's no human to blame for a crash. So all eyes are on the technology and you have to make sure the technology is right. That leads into the second piece, which is you need to have trust. People like to trust themselves as drivers, for better or worse, but they know that their hands in their own fate if they're the driver or usually someone they know. Cars aren't that big for passenger vehicles. And now you're putting some faith, some blind faith, some would say, into this computer that's taking you down the road. You need to have a lot of trust in the safety for that. And so getting level four right is really important. It ends up being all about trust.
Thank you for your insights, Phil. We actually know that there are companies out there claiming to have level 4 features close to serious deployment. Do you consider the currently available technology to be safe enough to let the drivers activate those level 4 features?
I've been hearing that completely self-driving autonomous cars are going to be here next year for how many years? You know, back in 1995, Carnegie Mellon had a car that went across the US 98% hands off the wheel. And for 25 years, we've been working on that last 2%. And we're back to, oh yeah, next year, the year after, for sure, this time for sure. And maybe yes, maybe no, but it's a really, really hard problem that always takes longer than most people say. So why is it so tough to answer the question, well, will they be here next year? One is, historically, it's always taken longer than people said, so there's that. Another is that there's a lot of secrecy. It's really hard to know what's going on. There's almost no transparency in the industry. So we really don't know. Now, in terms of will you be on the road next year and how much is your company stock worth and all those things, you know, those are interesting questions, but the thing I care about is safety. And for safety, there's no transparency there either. So even if you can say they'll be on the road next year for sure, we really have no idea how safe these things will be because the companies just aren't really talking about that. Now, there are a couple things that make this more problematic. One is that the companies are motivated to show progress to get funding. And so some companies, I believe, really care about safety more than anything else. Other companies, maybe not so much. We see them on the news sometimes. But the reality is, no matter how much you care about safety, if your company is going to go bankrupt if you don't get your next round of funding, no matter how good a person you are, no matter how well-intentioned you are, there's incredible pressure to get the demo going, even if safety isn't 100%. And that's just the nature of the industry. So you combine secrecy with incredible pressure to deploy. And in any industry, no matter who the people are, no matter how well-intentioned they are, no matter how much the engineers want to get it right, that's a recipe for bad outcomes. There's just too much pressure in the wrong direction. So I think because of the lack of transparency, the companies don't want to work collaboratively. It really needs to be on the companies to demonstrate they're safe, for example, by following safety standards. We can't just assume they're safe. The system just isn't set up for that to be a smart assumption.
In your long career field, you have seen and talked to many companies around this planet. Let me come to the cultural aspect, yeah, because we see, especially between the United States and the Europe and in the Asia region, there's a lot of different cultural aspects when it comes to safety. How do you see this? Do you think that there is a difference concerning the transparency and the safety culture between the different regions?
I've worked in, as you said, a bunch of industries. I've done rail. I've done a little bit of aerospace. I've done chemical process. I've done consumer products. In all these, I've dealt with the relevant safety standards and, of course, cars for many years. And the thing I come back to over and over, and I'm certainly not the only one to say this, is that safety culture is the thing that matters most. If people take safety seriously, you've got the largest part of the issue dealt with. And if people are just doing safety theater and not really taking safety seriously, there's really nothing you can do to fix that. So it's all about the culture. It always has been, it always will be. And what you really need to know is, are these companies really committed to safety, or is it just something they're saying to make people happy so they can get back to doing the functionality? Given that, one of the things that's changed when there's no human in the loop driving these vehicles is that there's nobody to clean up a mess if you got something wrong. You know, there's no one there to say, all right, there's a technical issue with this vehicle. The human driver is going to take control. In ISO 26262 functional safety standards, we see that as you take credit for controllability. Well, what does that mean if there's no person to control? It means it's all on the computer, right? And so when you get there, you're going to deploy with unknown unknowns. There are things in the real world that previously we said, well, the human will just figure it out, and there's no human. So to deal with these unknown unknowns, it's not possible to get it right. And even if you did get it 100% right, not even if you got it 100% right, you're going to find out that the world changes tomorrow, and you didn't guess that. So the only way to deal with this, in my mind, is feedback. You're going to deploy these things. You're going to do the best you can in making your autonomous vehicle safe. You're going to do the best you can. But then you're going to find out there's things you didn't know about, there's things that changed, and you're going to need field feedback to maintain safety. So that's a dramatic change. It's not going to be a recall anymore. It's going to be, well, every week we update for whatever it is we learned last week, and that's the only way to maintain safety over the life cycle.
That's an interesting aspect. You were mentioning the ISO 26262. There are actually a couple of widely known standards like this one out there addressing safety-related topics. Another example is the ISO/PAS 21448, the SOTIF, Safety of the Intended Functionality. Do you think that those standards address the challenges needed to bring autonomous vehicles on the road? Where do you see gaps that would need to be filled here?
I think both those standards are important. 26262 does functional safety, and that's great, but it assumes you have a complete understanding of the operating environment, complete understanding of the system, and it deals with, I'm going to oversimplify and just say it deals with internal faults in the system. Of course, you still have to do that. That doesn't go away. You know, people say, oh, we don't follow it because it doesn't apply to autonomous vehicles. Their company's saying this. That's ridiculous. Of course it applies. It doesn't solve everything, but the brakes still have to work, right? I mean, that didn't change. The steering still has to work. So that's 26262. 21448, which is about to be a real standard, the PAS is out there, but 21448 is in final approach to being issued, is about safety of the intended function. And that's more about a couple things. One is, I look at it as whether the requirements are complete. And some of it is that things like radars, you don't always get a pulse back every single time, so you have to deal with that. But from this point of view, the big thing in my mind is the SOTIF standard acknowledges that it's difficult to get complete requirements in an open world. So if you're doing throttle control or brakes, the operating environment is not that open-ended. You can understand what's going to happen. But if you're starting to do external world sensing, there's all manner of weird things that happen in the real world, and they're changing all the time. And SOTIF is trying to grapple with that to make sure your requirements are complete. There's good news and bad news. The good news is for a restricted operating environment, SOTIF can get you complete enough to deploy. But the bad news is you have to have a lifecycle feedback. And one of the things that is stronger in this new version of SOTIF that's coming out, 21.448 that's coming out, is that the external feedback from deployment is going to be stronger. It has its own paragraph. So this is a really good progress. But both of these are only about driving. In the fancy terminology, it's the dynamic driving task, driving the car down the road. Well, drivers do more than drive. Drivers have to make sure the passengers are okay. They have to deal with post-crash situations. They have to deal with maintenance, make sure the maintenance is up to date. There, all these things that drivers do that aren't actually grabbing the steering wheel and going down the road. And neither one of these standards really touches on that. 26262 has some life cycle things, but again, it's assuming there's a person there who's smart enough to know not to deploy the vehicle when it's not safe to do so, and so on. So there are a bunch of system level safety things that are just either only partially covered or not covered at all in those two standards. And that's one of the primary reason I worked on ANSI UL 4600 was to make sure that all the rest of it is covered. Sure, your car knows how to drive, but that doesn't mean it's safe. There's a whole bunch of other things to cover. And 4600 is all about making sure you cover everything you need to put a safe autonomous vehicle on the road.
Very interesting, Phil. Thanks for your insights here. In your long career, you have been talking to a lot of industry players out there. You were able to identify the biggest pain points that they are currently challenging. Is there any insights you can give us on that? What are the biggest pain points that the industry is currently facing?
I'd say there are a couple pain points. Well, I'm sure the longer I sit here, the more pain points I can come up with, but I'll try and limit myself to the big ones. Mm-hmm. One big one is that it's very hard when you're building a perception and planning system for the open world to think of everything that can go wrong. There's an infinite number for practical purposes of different things that can show up on a road. And with machine learning, if you haven't trained on it, you may not know what to do, or worse, your machine learning system may have false confidence. It knows what to do, and it's completely wrong. So dealing with the long tail, heavy tail, I like to call it the heavy tail aspects of the real world, where there's a large number of things with very low probability, but in aggregate, they're too big to ignore. This is a huge problem. Machine learning isn't particularly well suited for it, but that's how the real world shows up. So I think a lot of the companies are struggling. Sure, the first 98% is easy, but the last 2% is hard, and the last 0.002% is very, very hard. So I think that's the biggest technical challenge now. Another challenge is safety. From a practical deployment challenge is safety, because no one really knows how to safety certify machine learning-based systems. It breaks all the usual assumptions that the current safety methodologies use. Now, there are ways around it. There are technical approaches, to be sure, but this is new ground we're breaking. So that's also a challenge. And if you're concentrating on functionality and not worried about safety, when you get functionality right, you're going to find out there's this huge safety challenge too. Some companies are aggressively going after the safety because they realize this, but some companies are still trying to get their cars to work. I hope they realize that once they turn that corner and look at safety, they're going to realize that they still have a significant issue. There's another one, which is societal acceptance and regulation and all those kind of things. Mm-hmm. That's more about the industry building trust with the public. And I've recently written a paper in conjunction with a lawyer where we argue the industry is not doing a particularly good job of building trust. We don't have to go there in this session, but it is a huge issue. And the industry needs to do better at not only building trust, but deserving the trust. Transparency, safety, those sorts of things.
This is a good transition, actually, to a question that I had planned to ask you. In the United States, the NHTSA is now forming a basis of regulation for new types of automated vehicles. Could you please share your assessment of the recent NHTSA safety rule for autonomous vehicles with our listeners?
Sure. The recent rule that I think you're referring to has to do with the FMVSS modification or interpretation. And it's a big deal, but on the other hand, it's really not a big deal, depending how you look at it. The ruling that just came out has to do with crash safety for autonomous vehicles. And what it says is that you no longer have to meet all the standard crash testing if you have a vehicle with no driver controls. And so it makes it legal in the U.S. to put a vehicle on the road that does not have a driver's seat as such, does not have a steering wheel, does not have foot control pedals. But it's important to keep in mind what this really does. I mean, it's really nice that NHTSA is getting out of the way so you can deploy vehicles that don't have a steering wheel. That's great. But the issue was never that they wanted it to have a steering wheel. The issue was that they assumed there was a steering wheel for testing. And so if there was no steering wheel, you couldn't pass the test because the test assumed a steering wheel. And so at a very, very simplistic level, they're saying things like, hey, you already had passenger safety. Now the driver doesn't have a steering wheel. There's no airbag in the steering wheel, but that's okay. Pretend it's a passenger seat and you're good to go. So it's just making giving a little more flexibility. So this is great. You know, it's progress. It shows NHTSA is trying to respond to the needs of industry. But the mistake people sometimes make is thinking that that's all you need. None of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, FMVSS, address computer-based system safety at all. They have nothing to say about software safety. And so these new rules do not say, well, if you follow this, your autonomous vehicle will be safe. No, that isn't what they say. What they say is, if you do this, we'll allow you to deploy because we got rid of the incidental stuff about crash safety. And it's only crash safety. That's what it covers. Back in late 2020, NHTSA also came out with a much more comprehensive document on autonomous vehicle regulation, which isn't being talked about anymore, but I think it was really important, and it's a shame to see it sort of languish. Back then, they came out with an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, ANPRM, that gave a comprehensive framework for how you could actually regulate autonomous vehicles in a sensible way. Not just the crash safety, but in fact, how to get the computer safety right as well. What they said was, hey, you know what? Industry has a bunch of standards. They have standards for safety, ISO 26262, ISO 21448, ANSI UL 4600. And by the way, there's security standards you can follow. And what they proposed was industry should follow its own standards that they wrote and show NHTSA that they followed the standards. And NHTSA could use that as a basis of regulation rather than having NHTSA try and come up with a bunch of new standards disconnected from industry. That wouldn't make sense. Say, well, let's just use industry standards. And that was a notice of proposed rulemaking. It came out at the end of the last administration. The comment period has come and gone, and we haven't heard anything from the government. But in my mind, that's the most viable approach to regulation. But for now, it's just sort of sitting there with nothing happening. So I think that's very promising, but no action yet.
Thanks for your insight on this, Phil. My next question is actually coming back to two topics that we already slightly touched earlier. One of them is collaboration, the other one is trust. Both of them were already mentioned. We know that autonomous vehicle, autonomous driving is a very competitive sector. And unfortunately, we sometimes hear that collaboration might reduce technology advantages for the parties contributing to such a collaboration. And we especially hear this from US-based companies, by the way. Do you understand this argument? What do you think about collaboration in the autonomous driving space in general? And which specific challenges should the industry players tackle together in the near future in order to build trust?
I think that the industry has been hurt by the perpetual narrative that we'll deploy next year. Mm. And so some of the thinking was that, well, you know, this stuff is going to be so much better than a human by next year. There's no point dealing with regulation. There's no point dealing with too much safety testing because by the time anyone can figure it out, we'll be done and it'll be safe. It's treated as a race, and victory is so imminent, there's no point doing any of the other stuff that in normal cars you would spend time on process rigor and safety standards. Like, let's just build it. It'll be so much better. There's nothing to worry about. And that simply hasn't happened. We've been grinding on year after year with slow progress, but a narrative of it's almost done. And it's created a false sense of urgency. Oh, we don't have time to do this because it'll be done tomorrow. And every year we wait, people are dying. So just let us do whatever we need to get there. Now, If after 1 year they had deployed a car that was 10 times safer than a human, it's an interesting question whether that would have been an ethical, viable thing to do. But here we are, years and years and years later, and we're still not there. We have We have a couple companies with very limited scale demos in very benign environments, but we're nowhere near at scale deployment. And now we're being promised trucks will be out next year or the year after. Maybe this time it will be different, but is that the smart bet given the history? You know, the listeners will have to decide what they think about that. But the issue is that a lot of the companies have sort of skipped over traditional safety because they say, well, it takes too long, it's too hard, let's just get down to solving the problem. And I think in retrospect, that's kind of a mistake. There was plenty of time to do safety. It's years and years and years. Why was there no time? It's been years. So I think the industry should step back and say, you know what, this is going to take a lot longer than the people hyping it said. People like to say a lot longer than anyone thought. They didn't ask me. I could have told them. And I'm not the only one. There's plenty of people who could have told them. So I'm going to say longer than the hype said. You know, they could have been doing safety the whole time, and some companies have been, but a lot of them, you know, not so much. So I think safety should be a given. I think we should just say, look, we're not going to deploy this unless we really have a firm grasp on safety. And that's important for the industry. So there's a saying in the airplane business that when an aircraft crashes, no one cares whose paint is on the side of the aircraft. It hurts the whole industry. Everyone's a little bit more afraid to fly after a big, scary crash. And I think with human-driven cars, somehow we've gotten past that. And, oh, it's another crash. That's expected. But I think right now, at least with the autonomous cars, every time there's a crash, that's headlines. And it doesn't matter whose car it is. It hurts the perception of the whole industry. So I would like to see the industry collaborate on safety. Go ahead, make your differentiation on where you deploy and how you deploy in your business model and the comforts and in the vehicle and all these things. But safety should be a given. Every car should be as safe as every other car if it's autonomous, because that's the only way you get public trust in the industry. You know, airplanes are still, people still fly because they know that the regulators help work with the industry to keep things safe. And when that doesn't happen, it's news because it's so unexpected. And the car industry needs to get to that same place. And just historically, anyone with a big crash is a big loser. Look at what happened with the Uber ATG fatality. Now that's 4 years ago. Not only is Uber ATG not around anymore, that really hurt them. They had to stop deploying on the roads for, I think it was about 8 months. So they lost 8 months in the race because of one crash. The financial implications of that are enormous. When you're building, when you're burning more than $1 million a day, 8 months is a lot of money, right? And eventually they didn't make it. But all the other companies had to stand down too, right? So this really hurt the whole industry. And the next crash is going to do that too. Local Motors recently had a crash in Canada. And right after that, they just disappeared. So even one crash is enough to be an existential threat to a company. And it hurts the whole industry. So I think the industry would be better off saying, all right, we're going to compete. We have secret sauce that does all sorts of cool things, but we're all going to cooperate on safety to make sure every company is at least a minimum level of safety. And there are no bad actors out there who cut corners to chase the funding, but then their crash gives the entire industry a punch in the eye. You don't want that.
Very interesting, Phil. Thank you for your insights here. Let me come to our audience, because we know that we have many young listeners in our podcast. So I would like to ask you, with all your experience over the last decades, if you were at the beginning of your career today, what would you choose to study and specialize in? What is the most important skill that will be needed in the upcoming years?
Well, it's interesting, because when you're young, you value different things than when you're old. Exactly. When I was young, I wanted to build computers. I had a passion for building computers. And my first job out of PhD was CPU designer, and I built my chip, the wafers on my wall, and I said, that was fun, let me try something else. And I got into embedded systems, and now I'm into safety. So you have to realize when you're young, you may end up in the same place 20, 30, 40 years later, but you may not, and that's okay. So I say follow your passion. It's preferable to follow a passion that pays, but you know, follow your passion, because if you enjoy it and you're good at it, you're going to have more success. But regardless, if you're in the computer area, get literate in safety and security. Both of them are going to matter. And it doesn't matter what you think you're doing for a living, either safety or security, or probably both, are going to be relevant to your career. at least take, when you're, if you're still in school, take a course in security for sure. And if your university offers it, take a course in safety, or at least get up to speed in safety, because it's going to matter. As a simple example, people who are building cloud infrastructure, you know, the people who built AWS or something like this, right? You know, they're building safety critical software. They may not realize it, but where do you think the HD maps are stored? And what happens if one of those maps gets corrupt? Right? There's all sorts of things. People who build cell phones. Well, what if the emergency call doesn't work? All these things are so intertwined to our lives that anything that touches a computer either is or is going to be some degree of safety critical. And by the way, if you don't have security, you don't have safety either. So you can't ignore these. Even if you're not a specialist, you have to be literate. And the other thing is to resist the temptation to think that code is all that matters. Coding camp does not make you a software engineer any more than learning how to use a hammer and a saw makes you a skyscraper architect. It doesn't work that way. So coding is learning a basic skill, but learning how to be an engineer, how to methodically design and put together complex systems is the skill that's really going to let you have a long, fulfilling career.
Okay. That's some good recommendations, Phil. Thank you for that. We talked about our young listeners. We know that we also have some managers in our audience. And my question to you is, what would you recommend to those managers in our autonomous driving sector? What are the priorities they need to have their companies focus on?
I guess for the managers who are in the self-driving car or autonomous vehicle business as alike, because self-driving doesn't really mean anything anymore. Mm-hmm. But for the folks in the autonomous vehicle industry, I would say there's two issues. One is companies get caught up in the race to the next funding round. And you have to realize this is a marathon. No matter what you get told, even if you hit the next target, there's going to be another target at least as hard behind it. And even if you get your fleet of 100 vehicles out on the road and everything works great, a couple of companies say they're there now, scaling up is a whole nother thing. It's the old software development story that the first 90% takes 90% of the time and the last 10% takes the other 90% of the time, except it may be worse than that, right? It's always going to take more. So you need to treat this as a marathon and plan strategically. If you're always incurring technical debt or cutting corners to get to the next deadline, it's going to catch up with you as it does. The second one is that safety culture matters. If you have a culture now where it's okay to cut corners to meet a deadline, what you're going to find is when it's time to scale up beyond a few vehicles, your approach is not going to be viable for safety. You're going to have to throw it away and start over. It's security and safety. If they're not in from the beginning, there's no way to add them later. And I understand the imperative to get to the point where you get that IPO or whatever, and then it's someone else's problem. And if that's your plan, that's your plan. But if you're trying to actually build a scalable service and you're not worried about safety and you have a good safety culture, you're going to find out that that's a showstopper somewhere down the line.
Phil, thank you very much. Our podcast episode is actually coming to an end. Thank you for taking your time and giving us some insights today. I think the audience could once again feel today your passion for safety in autonomous driving.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you also to all of our listeners today. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Phil. If you have any suggestions for our new Ask the Expert format or questions for our next episodes, please reach out to us via our contact form on the website or directly via email through contact@theautonomous.com. Stay tuned for our next episodes. Bye-bye. Thank you.